This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello, and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we're exploring environmental and economic pressures in the region, as well as learning about prediabetes and diabetes prevention. New testing by the Environmental Working Group has identified the presence of toxic fluorinated chemicals, broadly known as PFAS, in the tap water of dozens of cities across the U.S. where contamination was not previously known. Brittany Patterson of the Ohio Valley Resource has the story.
New testing by an environmental watchdog group finds dozens of cities across the country, including in Ohio, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania, have toxic non-stick chemicals in their tap water. As Brittany Patterson reports, the new data expands the number of water systems reporting PFAS contamination.
PFAS chemicals are found in everything from nonstick pans to pizza boxes to firefighting foams. But in the decades since they were created in a lab, the compounds have made their way into our blood and drinking water. New testing from the Environmental Working Group, an advocacy organization, finds the number of water systems previously thought to have detected PFAS chemicals is actually much higher. The group found 34 additional cities with PFAS compounds in their water systems. David Andrews is with EWG.
Well, I think this testing really highlights the enormous contamination problem that our country faces and the threat to drinking water really across the country. And hopefully it spurs additional action.
Effective water systems in the Ohio Valley include Columbus, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and Louisville. Congress and the EPA are currently considering regulatory action.
Hemp prices crashed recently by over 75% in just 6 months. As Liam Niemeyer reports, the drop has many Ohio Valley farmers feeling uncertain about the future.
Ohio Valley farmers planted more than 27,000 acres of hemp last year to cash in on a booming market for CBD products made from the newly legal crop. But as Liam Niemeyer reports, the price for hemp has crashed, and farmers are feeling the consequences.
CBD is a compound made from hemp that's become popular because many people believe it has a wide range of medicinal benefits. CBD sales had created high demand for hemp. As recently as July, Kentucky farmers could get more than $4 for each percentage of CBD derived from a pound of hemp. But by December, the price had crashed to less than a dollar. University of Kentucky agricultural economist Tyler Mark says the rapid increase in acres grown in the Ohio Valley and across the country created a big supply and drove down the price.
If price drops or if that percent CBD drops, those budgets can go negative pretty quickly.
That means many Ohio Valley farmers in some cases are sitting on thousands of pounds of hemp hoping the market recovers. That includes Central Kentucky farmer Tony Silvernail.
People were like offering pennies on the dollar, and it's just like, you know what? At this point, I'll burn it before I, you know, give it away at that point.
Silvernail says he thinks the crash might keep people from growing this upcoming year. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
Next up, from WMMT's Sydney Bowles, a look into how some grocery stores in rural Appalachia are struggling to remain open as the industry declines.
With declining populations and stagnant incomes, many rural communities across the Ohio Valley are struggling to retain their grocery stores. Reporter Sydney Bowles visited Inez, Kentucky on the last day that its grocery store was in business, leaving the community asking, what's next?
The deli is empty and dark. The shelves are mostly bare. Every so often, a customer trundles a rickety shopping cart through the silent aisles. This is the last day of business for the IGA in Inez in eastern Kentucky's Martin County. This store has been a fixture here since 1959, when Durrell Ousley moved to the area and noticed there wasn't a grocery store in the county seat. Durrell's daughter, Judith, was 4 years old when the store opened, and she took it over when her dad got older.
I've done my best to try to keep it going, but when the coal industry left, so did a lot of people, so it's rough.
The IGA wasn't the only food option in town, but it was close. The other one is a discount grocery that doesn't sell any produce. Starting today, people who live in Inez will have to drive roughly 10 miles over the mountain to Warfield or leave the county if they want to buy fruits or vegetables. Sarah Congleton is already feeling the loss.
My assistant Robin and I are searching the county trying to find just bagels, not even whole wheat bagels, but just bagels. And we can't.
Congleton is Martin County's Family and Consumer Science Extension Agent for the University of Kentucky. Congleton says losing the IGA could cause serious ripple effects.
You know, if we're trying to combat food accessibility, and then there goes your grocery store, what do we do?
Inez joins a growing list of rural communities losing their grocery stores as declining populations mean fewer shoppers and independent groceries can't compete with larger chains. According to an analysis by the Ohio Valley Resource, between 2010 and 2015, 135 counties in the Ohio Valley saw an increase in people with low access to a grocery store. That is, people who live in urban areas living more than half a mile from a grocery store, or people in rural areas who live more than 10 miles from one. That's about half the counties in the region and higher than the national average.
We often get phone calls saying, okay, the grocery store just closed, what can we do?
That's Ryle Carver, project manager at Kansas State University's Rural Grocery Initiative. And she says it's a tough time for rural groceries, but it's also an exciting time.
We have seen in the last couple of years more examples of different ownership models. So instead of that traditional mom and pop, maybe it's the community stepping in and maybe the community owns the store, or maybe the community runs the store.
Some towns have government-run grocery stores or nonprofit groceries. And in one Kentucky town, another IGA is finding its own creative way to stay afloat.
So these are the new cases?
That's our cases.
Gwen Kristen owns the Isom IGA about an hour and a half south of Inez in Letcher County. Kristen noticed the same trends Judith Ousley did. As coal mining went away, there was less foot traffic in her store, and people had fewer dollars to spend. So she took out a loan from MACID, the Mountain Association for Community and Economic Development, to install closed-door cases that would save money on her electric bills. She's also investing in a new roof, which will also help cut costs.
And then once we get the roof on, my next step that I want to do is go to solar.
Back in Martin County, there's no certainty about what's going to happen next, either for the building where the IGA has been or for the community. Inez IGA employee Crystal Newsom got a job at the Warfield IGA for now, but pretty soon, she hopes to move away.
It's sad, I guess. Yeah. It's just going to be a ghost town.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Inez, Kentucky.
While you might know that your diet can be a risk factor for prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, other health issues can affect your blood sugar as well, and you might not even know it's happening. As part of an ongoing WMMT series featuring local voices reflecting on prediabetes and preventing type 2, Parker Hobson interviewed Willa Johnson from Letcher County.
I think like when we talk about diabetes, we talk about it in such a basic way that like people don't realize how easily it could change. How like you might not be showing any symptoms and then suddenly you do. My name is Willa Johnson. I'm from McRoberts, Kentucky, and we are here at Apple Shop, where I work as the director of Appalachian Media Institute. So I've struggled my whole life with several health conditions that were basically just undiagnosed, but I never had issues with sugar or anything like that. But what I did have issues with was my period. And then just the last couple years, found out I had polycystic ovarian syndrome, and that's where a lot of my health problems lie. And so I've been having a lot of issues with iron and anemia. And so through the blood work of trying to get my iron levels raised, we realized that my glucose levels were on the rise, which is apparently very directly related to polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I had no clue. And so I wasn't eating a diet that was, one, good for my iron and protein intake, but also wasn't good for prediabetes. Whenever my levels first started going up, the first thing the doctor did was put me on metformin. And I hate taking pills. I hate taking medication. And so I did it for a little while, and then it wasn't making much of a difference. And I just wasn't, like, taking them as regularly as I should. And so when I went back the second time, my levels were still high. I was like, I want to talk about a diet. Like, let's sit down and have that conversation. Don't just up the medication. And so that's when I started to notice a big difference. And I haven't went back and tested my levels since I've done this, mostly because I started moving. But I can tell a difference in energy. I can tell a difference in how I feel. And so I can only imagine that it's helped so far. My doctor and I sat down and wrote out a diet for me. So she really sat down and, like, we planned it out together. Like, it was a really simple thing. Like, eat this many color vegetables with each lunch. And then at dinner, it's, like, mostly protein, vegetables that aren't red, orange, or yellow. Those are your higher starch vegetables. So just thinking more greens, less yellows on the plate. It is a little challenging, especially when you have, like, the only other person you're cooking for in your house won't eat meat and also doesn't want to eat a lot of vegetables. So, you know, moms struggle a lot with food and what they eat for a reason. It's really hard to, like, cook a good meal for yourself and cook a good meal that a child will eat. And so, like, those things are challenging. Things like if you're at work and everybody wants to go out to eat and you're in an area like this where there's not healthy options to go out to. Things like that become a challenge. But I think for me, it's mostly planning. If I really spend time, I try to spend Sundays as much as I can, like spending time thinking about what I'm going to eat that week, mapping it out, going to the store, cooking things, prepping things. It sucks. It takes up your entire day. But those are the weeks that I do the best and feel the best. So it's just an investment. But the town I work in and the town I live in are pretty much 30 minutes apart, which doesn't feel like a lot, but it is after a long day. Just the other day, I was like really wanting to cook a good, healthy meal at my new house, and I didn't want to drive 30 minutes to Whitesburg, so I went to the Neon grocery store, and there was no fresh food to buy other than potatoes. I couldn't buy bananas for him. The strawberries were rotted. There were no good peppers. Like, just getting to get to a store that has good produce is a big problem for people who aren't living in the county seat. And especially when you have a kid, like, you know, you're putting them in the car seat, you're packing all their things, you're getting them out, like, especially for, like, moms who are parents in general who do it alone, all those little things are just so exhausting if you do them repetitively all the time. I joke that sometimes I hire babysitters to go to the grocery store, and that's legit the truth. Both of my parents are diabetic, and they're both type 2 diabetic, and I think they're from a generation that, like, they grew a lot of their own food, but they also were, like, the generation that was introduced to a lot of processed food, and so they think anything out of the garden's healthy, and they also think anything that says sugar-free is healthy, or just not understanding that sugars and starches are very similar. And so they'll say, I haven't had any sweets today. And I'm like, but you had potatoes today. But I think nationally, we're just really unhealthy. We want everything quickly. We want everything to last a long time and not rot. We want the processed stuff. It's this weird, like, body blaming game of, like, only the overweight have this problem and it's their fault. It's that, like, they've done this to themselves. The truth is, like, we're all taking in so many substances in our diet that cause our bodies to overproduce insulin or underproduce insulin. Yeah, if you're eating a mostly processed diet, like, chances are, even if you're not pre-diabetic, you're gearing that direction. Type 2 diabetes, like, I see so many people get diagnosed, or they're like, being warned that they're close to that level, and it's this mentality of, like, they're living with it, they're not dying, they're not in bed and unable to participate in life, they're living with it. And so you can live with it too, and, like, it's just part of who we are, and culturally it's just normalized. I think that's one thing, like, I'm just so self-conscious about, is watching people in my family take a handful of medication every morning or every night, and just thinking, like, there has to be a better way. And I don't know that, like, we're doing a good enough job teaching younger people different than that. Like, you don't have to live this way because your mother or your grandmother or your grandfather lived this way. Like, there are things you can do, or you should demand your community help you do to have a better life than adding another prescription. Anytime the conversation goes to like food or weight or diabetes, like I immediately get uncomfortable. I immediately shut down. And I think a lot of people probably feel that way. Especially, I mean, you know, young girls, like so much of what we put on our value is our appearance, and we don't want to talk about it. And so I just see young girls just continually beat themselves up or say, I'll take whatever medication you give me because there's nothing I can do about this. Instead of saying, like, you're going to mess up, you're going to make mistakes, it's not going to be easy, but, like, let's try to do what we can do. And so I think you got to find what's best for you, but I think there are healthy versions of diets out there for everyone. Going asking your doctor to take your blood levels and to, like, then decide from there. Like, I had no idea that I had, like, almost zero protein. And then I think just being really easy with yourself when you mess up, it's not all or nothing. My favorite quote that I use for people who are struggling with this is, if you miss a step, you don't throw yourself down the stairs. So, like, if you have a bad day, you don't just throw in the towel, you keep going. Do the best you can. Make mistakes when they happen. But I think being gentle with yourself and easy with yourself is the best thing I could give anybody information to do.
You've been hearing from Willa Johnson from Letcher County. Prediabetes can be caused by more than just your diet, and it's possible to have it without even knowing it. But if you get your blood sugar tested and you do have prediabetes, health workers say it's not too late to make changes that can slow or even prevent type 2 diabetes. There's a program set up to help with these changes called the Diabetes Prevention Program, and it's offered in small groups at the Kentucky River District Health Department, Juniper Health, the Clover Fork Clinic, the Johnson County and Clay County Health Departments, and online. For more, and for a short quiz to see if you might be at risk, check out doihaveprediabetes.org. For WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
If you're interested in taking a short quiz to see if you might be at risk for prediabetes, you can find one online at doihaveprediabetes.org. In the second segment in a series on economic development in Pound, Virginia, WMMT's Sydney Bowles speaks with Margaret Sturgill of the Pound Historical Society. Margaret shares the history of Pound and how the community is coming together to build a new and exciting tourism economy.
Margaret Sturgill is the president of the Pound Historical Society. The Historical Society records the history of Pound, Virginia, but it's not only concerned with the past. In the second segment in a series about economic development in Pound, I sat down with Margaret to talk about her work with the Pound Economic Development Authority and Marley Green, who we heard from in the last segment.
Can you tell me a little bit about Pound?
I was born and reared here. Pound at one time was a booming little town, and we were very dependent on the people from Eastern Kentucky, from Jenkins, to come over here. We had lots of alcoholic establishments. We had about 7 bars in our town. And Jenkins was dry, which meant you couldn't sell alcohol over there. So in addition to all of our businesses, we had all the Kentucky folks come shop. And of course, alcohol was a draw, but that was not what made us busy. But at one time, it was a booming little town. We've had a lot of tragic things happen to our little town, like all other little towns in Virginia and Eastern Kentucky too. But I'm proud of our little town. We're seeking to bring it back to life.
Can you tell me about the Historical Society?
The Historical Society was organized in 1992. We're nonprofit. We have published 4 history books of the Pound. We are in the process of publishing another book.
What are those books?
It's just history of the Pound. Okay. It's our written history, and it's old pictures, a way of recording our past.
Margaret, I have a question for you.
Yes.
I've always called this place Pound, but you call it The Pound.
The Pound.
What's that about?
Well, as early as the late 1800s, on an old map, the Pound River Country was mentioned. The Pound River Country. There's several stories of how the Pound got its name. One says it was because the Indians impounded their horses in a little section here called our Pound Bottom. The other story is that it's because of the old Robertson Mill that pounded corn and wheat into flour. But I think personally, and some of the other members of our historical society thinks the Pound was probably named from an early surveyor with the last name Pound.
But then you don't only preserve the history of Pound, right? You also work on projects for the future.
That's kind of, we have actually taken on their little city park over here near the town hall. We talked to the people at Lowe's in Wise, and they gave us a little grant of $2,500. And because we're nonprofit, I think that was our success in getting that. That bought new picnic tables, bought new lighting for our little park, and resurfaced our pavement. So we look for projects that we can do with very little money, because we're not, you know, we don't have money, but if we can do it through grants and donations.
I'm not from here. I moved here, I don't know if you can tell from my accent.
Yes.
I moved here about a year and a half ago. And I'm a reporter. I cover economic development. Mm-hmm. And I'm so fascinated by all the different ways that all different kinds of people think about bringing back their towns.
Right.
And sometimes it's an industrial park, and sometimes it's a factory, and sometimes it's, I don't know, a prison. But what you're talking about and thinking about seems different.
Well, I think our history will help bring our town back. We recently had a very successful storytelling convention right here on this property.
The Red Fox Storytelling.
Red Fox Storytelling. We had a big tent out here, and I guess we had, I'm guessing 150 people attend that storytelling. We kind of expanded the storytelling. This was our second event. The first event was mainly about the Pound Gap Massacre. This year, we expanded that, and we had an open mic and allowed people to stand up and tell a story, which was a treat for all of us. And the other thing is, the site here is where Edith Maxwell lived, and who she was convicted of killing her father with a high heel slipper, hitting him in the head. Well, this is where she lived. So we told that story too. So we've expanded. That, along with our little farmers market that we began to have in here when we got the building this past fall. And we would have Tuesday night farmers market and covered dish. You know, they say if you feed them, they'll come. Well, they came. And all of October, we had such a good crowd. The little building was full, the picnic tables were full, and we had our little farmers out there selling their produce.
What does it feel like to see all of these new exciting things happening?
Well, I'm excited. I'm very excited. The one thing we do need to do is get our youth involved, because the youth is the life of our town. We've recently had school consolidation, so we've lost our high school. And you know, when you lose your high school, you lose that youth and that life in your town. So we've got to figure out how to get our youth involved in whatever we can get started in our little town.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, there's a lot of school consolidation happening.
Yes. And when the four-lane bypassed the town, that hurt us too, because it's easier to zip to Norton, you know, mm-hmm. than to. So we've got to have something that's going to draw the crowd into the pound.
Yeah. How did you, tell me about the work that you've been doing with Marley.
We're so pleased to have Marley on the EDA. I am recording secretary for the Pound Economic Development. Marley is co-chair. And for several years, the EDA was kind of stumped on where to start, what to do. And Marley came up with the idea of having community forums. We had a series of three, and he had it mapped out. Our first session, we came up with ideas, things we were dreaming. And then everyone voted on those ideas.
What were some of those ideas?
Well, one idea that I remember is one that I mentioned. That's why I remember it. But it was to continue our river walk. We've got our little footbridge here, and I suggested that we try to do another bridge to connect the Pound Bottom with the bypass. Mm-hmm. And you could walk all the way around the Pound River. So we thought that was a very good idea as far as tourism.
Mm-hmm. So that was the first meeting.
That was the first meeting. The second meeting, Marley brought us a map, and we marked places in town that were, it was a business and we needed to support it. It was a vacant building that could be a business. It was a vacant building that had to be torn down, or it was an empty lot where something could be built. So that was a nice, good meeting. The third meeting, Marley had the town manager of Norton come and tell us about some of his, Fred Ramey, some of his successes in Norton, and gave us some ideas of how we might find resources. So with that, we'll take it back to our EDA regular meeting and see if we can perhaps find funding, either from grant or private funding, for a project. But the main thing is that Marley put us on the right track to have a project.
It kind of sounds like the idea, the big idea behind it is like, instead of just trying to create jobs, it's trying to create a place that people want to live and want to visit.
Yes, especially to visit. To visit, and then we've got to build our community up. We've got to have a place for them to want to. We've got to have something unique to get people to come off the four lane into the pound.
Yeah.
And I think we've started to spark, and I'm hoping it's going to grow.
Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Margaret Sturgill of the Pound Historical Society. I'm Sydney Bowles, and you're listening to Mountain News on WMMT.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org. Or download Mountain News as a podcast from SoundCloud or Stitcher. Music in Parker Hobson's piece about prediabetes and type 2 Music in Parker Hobson's piece about prediabetes and type 2 diabetes prevention features Good Dog Josie and Beware the Lone Star Tick, both by Don Beekhoff and both from the Free Music Archive. Music in the host segments of this episode feature Jean Ritchie with a tune called Stream of Time from her album Sweet Rivers. That album was released by Appleshop's own June Apple Recordings in 1981. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.